Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of June 4th through 11th. We're starting our summer schedule, and this week we feature an interview with Ross Douthat, the New York Times columnist and author of the new book, Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. I spoke with Ross from his offices in Washington, D.C., and I began by asking him to recount the unusual story of how Christian Orthodoxy found a home in America.
Sure. I mean, part of, you know, the subtitle of my book is How We Became a Nation of Heretics, and I think one of the obvious rejoinders to the argument I make is that, well, hasn't America always been a nation of heretics, right? And this is sort of woven into our national DNA, in a sense, that we're a nation that prides itself on sort of making a home for dissenters, free thinkers of every stripe, and also for sort of religious experiments that fall within the bounds of Christianity, but sort of take Christian ideas in all kinds of wild directions, whether it's Mormonism, Christian Science, what have you. And I think all of that's absolutely true. The point I'm trying to make in the course of the book is that what's part of what has made religion, I think, a positive force in American life historically has been a kind of fruitful tension between, on the one hand, exactly that spirit of sort of perpetually multiplying heresies, but on the other hand, a strong presence for a more sort of institutional and traditional form or forms of Christian faith. And so when I talk about orthodoxy in the book, I am talking about a small O orthodoxy, right? I'm not talking about sort of the definitions of orthodoxy as laid down in the Council of Trent. I'm talking more about a definition that would encompass both, you know, Roman Catholicism, but also many of the historic Protestant denominations, Eastern Orthodoxy as well, and so on, a sort of a creedal Christianity oriented around the consensus of the early centuries of the church, basically. And I think that you can see that kind of small O orthodoxy in evidence throughout American history, taking various forms as different denominations rise and fall. Obviously, there's a big difference between sort of the shape that institutional Christianity took in 17th century America, you know, when it was heavily Congregationalist, Calvinist, and so on, 19th century America, when it was more Methodist and Baptist, and then by mid-20th century America, encompassing a robust Catholic Church as well. But I think that institutional presence, and an institutional presence that's made a real attempt to root itself in, you know, a deep connection to the Christian past, has been a really important part of the American story. And so the story I tell in the book is a story of decline, not from some golden age when everybody was perfectly orthodox and, you know, recited the Nicene Creed six times before they went to bed at night, but from an era when there was, I think, a more robust expressions of institutional Christian faith than there are today.
Right. You write that heresy, there's always been kind of a tension between heresy and orthodoxy. You call it its grumpy but indispensable twin.
Right. I think that's a quote. It's a quote from somebody. But yes, I'm include in my introduction this, you know, the famous quote from G.K. Chesterton, where he sort of envisions Christian orthodoxy as sort of this wild chariot ride through the ages, you know, where, you know, sort of avoiding this heresy and that heresy and so on. But I also say that I think that vision doesn't necessarily give heresy enough credit, and that actually, you know, in various forms, sort of what Peter Berger calls the heretical imperative is very important to Orthodox itself and to, you know, to Christianity as a whole, that you need to have this sort of, you need to have tensions, you need to have arguments and so on. So I'm not, the book is very critical of contemporary heresies, but it's not making the case that, you know, we should desire to live in a world with, you know, where such heresies don't exist at all. I'm interested in sort of trying to restore a balance, I think, more than I am in, you know, some dream of inquisitorial conquest.
The idea being that the balance has shifted too far in the direction of certain heresies.
Right. The idea being that, you know, one of the examples that I tended to use in interviews is to, you know, compare a figure like Billy Graham, circa, you know, 1960 or so, to a figure like Joel Osteen, circa 2011, 2012, right? And, you know, Osteen is sort of, in a way, one of the contemporary heirs to Graham. He is a sort of, you know, a high-profile evangelist who has a high-profile ministry. He sells out baseball stadiums. And he has, like Graham, a very inclusive vision of Christianity, right? He's preaching God's universal love, and as with Graham, that's a big part of his appeal. But if you go back and sort of track, you know, Graham's sermons and his theological style and so on, Graham was always able to sustain what I think is a very healthy balance between a message of love, inclusion, and forgiveness and so on, but also a message of sin and judgment. And that, I think, is what is absent from, you know, from basically all and anything that someone like Joel Osteen has to say. But I think that balance in general is too often absent from contemporary religion. That you know, part of the genius of Christianity historically has been to sort of maintain that kind of both and synthesis. And that's, you know, to the extent that things have changed for the worse in American religion over the last few generations, I think it's the loss of that synthesis and sort of the over accentuation of sort of elements that only really make sense when they're part of a larger whole.
Now, as you indicate, you cover several strands of Christian orthodoxy, Billy Graham, also you write about Martin Luther King. Our readers and listeners are going to be most interested in the Catholic story. And so there's a couple points here I thought might be worth talking about. One is that you note at one point that a lot of energy, at least I guess in the last 40, 50 years since Vatican II, has been spent on kind of some of these inter-Catholic battles, you know, and that as a result, perhaps, there aren't the kind of great Catholic witnesses, voices to the secular world, as there might have been, say, in the 40s and 50s. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the themes of the book is that starting in the 60s and 70s, institutional Christianity was presented with a very particular set of challenges, ranging from partisan polarization to the sexual revolution to sort of making the gospel compelling in a extremely wealthy consumerist society to just the fact of sort of globalization and decolonization and the almost inevitable spirit of relativism, I think, those trends encouraged. And I think that the Christian church is sort of divided over how to respond to these trends, but in Catholicism, the church divided itself, right? You had and we think of this as sort of the liberal-conservative clash, but I try out a different set of terms. I call it the clash between sort of accommodation and resistance, right? Between the idea that basically the church needs to sort of keep up with these changes in order to maintain its relevance, and the idea that, no, these changes need to be resisted and so on. You know, I think that obviously that debate is very important, and I have my own biases, and readers are going to come away, you know, I'm more sympathetic to John Paul II and Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict's views on some of those questions than I am to some of their liberal critics, for instance. But I'm also trying to make the point that, you know, no matter which side you come down on in these inter-Catholic disputes, the fact of these disputes has become sort of, it dominates Catholic witness to an extraordinary degree. And you see this, you know, you see this in just something like what's been happening at Georgetown over the last couple months, where, you know, Paul Ryan comes to speak, and you have, you know, one letter of protest, and then Kathleen Sebelius is invited to speak, and you have another letter of protest, and you have sort of it's Georgetown versus the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington. And I mean, and this is obviously reproduced in the media landscape, where instead of there being Catholic publications, there are publications that are identified as Catholic and conservative or Catholic and liberal and so forth. And again, you know, sort of pointing this out doesn't make these differences go away. And I participate in these arguments myself all the time and have in some of the back and forth over the book. But I think when it comes to sort of understanding why, you know, sort of Catholic witness seems weaker in the secular society maybe than it did 50 years ago, I think it's because Catholicism has been and remains in a sort of perpetual state of civil war.
Now, you mentioned the term accommodation and resistance. This is something that I think for some of our listeners and readers, this might, you know, raise some concerns because they might consider themselves perhaps being put in the accommodationist camp. What would you say to those who believe that maybe is an unfair word, especially considering that, you know, liberal Catholics would perhaps argue that they resist the culture on many issues, including torture, abortion, capital punishment. So
this is actually one of the reasons why I preferred the term accommodation to liberal, because I am being the argument I'm trying to make is that basically that one of the things I think that liberal Catholics in particular need to come to terms with and maybe have not sufficiently is just the extent to which the sort of a lot of the post-Vatican II experiments did not lead to the kind of fruits that the people who started those experiments seemed to expect they would lead to. And that if you look at sort of the institutional life of the church, the vocational life of the church, you know, the religious orders that are attracting new priests and so on, and, you know, if you look at sort of mass attendance and across a variety of indicators, there was a real, I think there was a failure more on the liberal side than on the conservative side to sort of sustain the what I think is, you know, ultimately the foundation of Catholicism, which is the institutional life of the church. And that failure does not mean that the conservatives were right about everything and the liberals were wrong about everything. But it does, I think, need to lead to at least some, I mean, you see this in the debates, some reassessment of sort of, well, what actually went wrong. And so, for instance, in something like the, you know, the debates about the state of American, you know, women's religious orders, right, where, you know, a lot of liberal Catholics understandably have their hackles raised when they read the criticisms of nuns being handed down from the Vatican. You don't have to agree with all those criticisms to see that these religious orders have not sustained themselves, have not sort of produced a new generation of vocations, and that the experiments that at least some of them embarked on 40 or 50 years ago have not sort of created they haven't created a sustainable future for themselves. And so, again, maybe the Vatican doesn't have the right answers for what ails women's religious orders, but it's not enough to just say, well, you know, we need to keep going in exactly the direction that we started going in 1965 or so. So again, sort of this is sort of a long-winded answer, but to circle back to why I use the term accommodation, I think that there is a and can be a, you know, a liberal Catholicism and a liberal Christianity that is a very healthy and vibrant expression of Christian faith. I think that's been a huge part of the Catholic story and the American story. I think the challenge for liberals, though, is to avoid the temptation to just sort of accommodate yourself to whatever happens to be happening in the culture. And I think that was a temptation that too many Catholics succumbed to in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
And I think, I mean, even I work at a publication that could be called a liberal Catholic publication.
In the Jesuit tradition.
In the Jesuit tradition. I think even in these circles, just to give a little feedback, there is some recognition that in the 70s, perhaps there was, for example, a little experimentation that perhaps maybe went too far in one direction. But there was, it's not that folks are keep pushing in that direction.
No, there are a couple points, too, that I want to be clear on. First, I'm not making the argument that if it hadn't been for Vatican II, all would be well in American Catholicism, and vocations wouldn't have declined, and mass attendance wouldn't have dropped, and so on. I'm specifically making the argument that there were deep tectonic shifts at work in American life that made something like what happened in the 60s and 70s inevitable. And I'm also arguing that, as much as I'm critical of it, a lot of the what I call the accommodationist response was a totally understandable response to those shifts, undertaken out of a totally legitimate desire to sort of maintain, save, and keep relevant institutions that people loved. I think if when I go back and look at the, at least some of the sort of, vision of progressive Christianity that was articulated in that era, I can see why people found it so appealing and thought, yes, this is the future that we need to embrace. But as I've been saying, I think looking back on it two generations hence, the feeling that I have is more of a sense that, a lot, a lot was squandered in this period. And this is, I mean, this is where there is, I think, just, there's also just an inevitable generational divide, right? Where I think for Catholics, for Catholics of my generation, I think it is, who did not come of age with the pre-Vatican II Church, I think it's easy for us to sort of make look at sort of what looks like the strength, robustness, resilience, and so on of American Catholicism pre-Vatican II, and underestimate the extent to which it was confining, repressive, and intellectually sterile. That I think may be, you know, the thing my generation can't always see. But I think the older generation sometimes doesn't recognize that from the sort of younger Catholic point of view, we look at sort of trends in church architecture, liturgy, and so on in the 60s and 70s, and just feel like a lot was squandered there.
Right.
And that's probably where, you know, some of where my own perspective is coming from.
Well, that's helpful. Thank you for unpacking that for us. I want to pick up on a couple points you pick up in the second half of your book. One is the notion of God within and that part of the culture. I think you make a very good case that this can be really isolating in a lot of ways and kind of lonely when you think about it. How can Christian institutions, Catholic Church, make the case for community in kind of this spiritual but not religious culture?
It's a hard challenge, and one of the, you know, one of the underlying issues and one of the reasons that my book is sort of shot through with a certain amount of pessimism is that these trends towards individualism, towards skepticism of institutions, these trends away from community and so on, these aren't just religious trends, right? I mean, these are trends that are apparent in the culture as a whole. They're apparent in the famous, you know, the decline of bowling leagues that Robert Putnam famously talked about. It's apparent in the loss of faith in non-religious institutions, whether it's, you know, government, Wall Street, and so on. So there isn't sort of an easy answer, and the trends that I'm describing are trends that are common to the culture as a whole. I mean, to the extent that I have a prescription, it is, you know, it's not a sort of 5-point plan for church renewal, but I do try and stress the idea that ultimately the best case for Christianity is an attractively lived Christian faith, and that the best case for why someone should want to join a Christian community is that a Christian community produces a certain level of human flourishing that seems more attractive than the alternatives on offer. So my book is not at all making the case, say, that Christians should withdraw from politics. In fact, I think that, you know, Christians have an obligation to be deeply engaged in politics, or that Christians should withdraw from argument and polemic, which is obviously what I do for a living. But in terms of, like, you know, in terms of what's actually going to guarantee a future for Christianity in general and Catholicism in particular, I do think it's sort of, it's models in ordinary life that are ultimately going to be more important than certainly some of the culture war stuff that professional writers tend to be consumed by. And, you know, in the end, I mean, if you look back at sort of the rise of Christianity in the Roman Empire, for instance, part of what made Christianity so appealing was that Christians seemed to know something that other people didn't about how to live in community with one another, how to genuinely love one another. And it's that model in the end that's the only really compelling witness, I think, for Christianity in a, you know, sort of diverse and fragmented society like ours.
You also have a compelling section on, you know, Christian thinking on sexuality, and this is a time where a lot of people probably think, well, you know, we've moved past this and perhaps would prefer if the church didn't speak about these things. But you make the case that it's pretty integral to the church's tradition. Is it possible, you think, to rescue some of these notions of you know, traditional Catholic teaching on sexuality, or is kind of that horse left the barn?
Well, there's no place, I think, in American culture where the traditional Christian message, you know, rubs up so uncomfortably against the spirit of the age. And certainly, I'm 32 years old, so my social cohort just lives through our post-college years. And if the Christian sexual message is a hard message for American culture to hear as a whole, it's a incredibly hard message to hear for young people for whom, you know, the way our society works is that you become sexually mature as a teenager and then you get married 10 or 15 years later.
Right.
And this huge space with no real sort of social structures or, you know, rules for figuring out, you know, how to be a sexual being. I mean, it's a huge space in which that the traditional Christian message of chastity before marriage just seems to have no purchase whatsoever. I mean, I'm very interested by a show like, you know, Lena Dunham's new show Girls on HBO, right? Because this is, you know, it's a show that maybe is a little bit more dystopian than the actual reality for early 20-somethings, but it's, you know, it's a vision of 20-something social life that's so distant from the models of sexuality that Christianity has traditionally offered. So again, I don't have, you know, some sort of 5-point plan for how to, you know, figure out what Christian churches should say to 23-year-olds about their sex lives. But I do think that it's a big mistake to say, well, you know, that means that the Christian churches just need to downplay sexuality. I mean, I think that there, you know, there has to be, as I say in the book, a holistic message on sexuality. It can't just be a message that says, you know, that the Christian sexual teaching boils down to, you know, gays can't get married, but whatever straights do is fine, right? I mean, that can't be the message. But at the same time, I think it's almost impossible to separate the broad Christian vision of sexuality as something that has a teleology, right? That is a gift that's supposed to be used for particular purposes from the Christian message as a whole. And so, you know, that doesn't mean that, say, you know, every Christian in America, you know, needs to get with the Catholic program on, you know, what, on everything that Humana Vitae says about birth control or something, right? I mean, I think there's room for Christian disagreement on particular issues related to sexuality, but that broad vision of, you know, chastity, continence, and sexuality as something that's oriented towards lifelong marital love and the bearing and rearing of children, that vision can't be jettisoned without really jettisoning the core of Christianity itself, I think.
Right, you have a good line in there about how that notion of sexuality, that idea of sexuality, has given things as ordinary as a good childhood to, you know, the lives of the saints, you know, for us to look to.
Right, and if you look at one of the recurring themes of my book is the idea that, you know, a lot of contemporary problems in American life have at least some connection to trends in contemporary religious belief. And I talk about that a bit with money and personal finances and so on, the way that sort of the prosperity gospel's vision of, you know, wealth as something that's just available to any believer who trusts in God enough, how that vision connects pretty easily to, say, the financial attitudes that gave us the housing bubble. But I think the same is true, you know, what's true of money is also true of sex. We're a society where 40% of births are out of wedlock, where the marriage rate is dropping, but also the, you know, people's satisfaction with their marriages has gone down as well since the 1970s. There's female self-reported happiness has actually dropped slightly since the 70s as well. We're not a society that has achieved some sort of really healthy post-sexual revolution equilibrium. And in that landscape, I think that the, you know, again, sort of these seemingly out-of-date Christian ideas actually have a lot potentially to offer.
I'm just thinking of some conversations we have around our editorial table, and I think everybody would agree with what you just said, but I think there is some concern sometimes that, at least within our circles, there's a lot of emphasis on the sexual teaching of the church, for example, and not as much on questions of war and, you know, what are traditionally considered perhaps liberal concerns. But do you think that's an issue in terms of when you talk about heresy, that, you know, Catholics perhaps aren't educated on these questions as well, peace and justice?
I suppose I would make a distinction, and this is probably where my own political conservatism comes in, between, I think it is absolutely true that the church can and should do more in being holistic, ethically holistic, not only within the realm of sexuality, but in the broader realm of sin as well. And so I, you know, talk a bit about, I mean, what any serious Christian critique of our society should be talking as much about gluttony, you know, I mean, when was the last time you heard a sermon about gluttony, right? Or, you know, and materialism in general, greed, hubris, and so on. So to that extent, I do, you know, I do share a lot of sort of what are conventionally liberal Catholic concerns. Where I stop short, though, is saying that this necessarily means that, you know, every bishop's letter should look like, you know, what was the famous 1984, whichever year it was, bishop's letter on the economy and
right.
so on, where you're just sort of going down the line of Democratic Party priorities and saying, you know, this is the church basically stands behind them. I think that there has to be a distinction between sort of specific policy views on sort of programmatic issues, where I think there does have to be room for a wide variety of Catholic perspectives. What is again the stereotypically conservative Catholic line on that front. But I agree with the liberal Catholics that the church does also, you know, does need to speak in sort of general moral terms about issues relating to wealth, capitalist culture, and so on.
Well, before I drag you any further into these Catholic culture wars, I have two more questions. One is, you write that you hope the book does reach beyond a Christian or even religious audience to non-believers, to secular thinkers. I know you've had a discussion on Slate about some of these questions. What has the response been from that audience so far?
I thought the discussion on Slate was very... It was with Will Salatin,
right.
who's a regular Slate writer, and he and I have had sort of fruitful exchanges before. So I really enjoyed that exchange. I thought it was a very good example of the kind of discussion I've been trying to stir up. I would say overall that the, you know, both the response to and the interest in the book has probably been, as I, you know, ultimately expected, stronger among the religious and the religiously inclined. That it has been among sort of people with what they themselves consider purely purely secular perspectives. So I'm not under any delusions that a book like this is suddenly going to, you know, re-Christianize the Harvard faculty or something like that. But at the very least, I've tried. You know, I mean, I went on Bill Maher's show on HBO and had, you know, by the standards of such shows, I think we had a reasonably productive 5-minute or so exchange about these issues. So I do think that there's at least some, you know, there's at least some sense among secular Americans that, you know, religious institutions are important, that religious questions are important, and that because religion isn't going away, these issues are going to remain important over the next few generations and therefore are worth arguing about.
Finally, I wonder if you could talk briefly about kind of the challenges of being a public Catholic intellectual in the secular media. I mean, as I have indicated, we bat around these questions, but it's within an institution that kind of takes for granted certain things, whereas in the secular world, that's not the case. So maybe you can speak to that.
Sure. It's a real challenge on the one hand, but it's also, it's a great opportunity, and I'm very fortunate, I think, to have the opportunity to write for an audience that often shares not only few but even none of my theological and metaphysical premises, and you know what it does mean though is that I sort of often cycle back and forth between very different styles of writing and argument, and it is, you know, it's very different to have a conversation about my book with someone like Will Salatin at Slate than
sure.
it is to, say, argue with a, you know, a reviewer for Commonweal or America or, you know, or First Things or the National Catholic Register or wherever. And I'm sure I don't always make that transition back and forth as smoothly as I can. But I think what's interesting in my position at the Times is that, you know, I often end up in sort of trying to find places where my own views and the views of even the most secular reader might overlap, and then sort of using that overlap as sort of an opening into a broader debate. And maybe I'm biased because I spend a lot of time doing this, but it does inform my broader perspective that, which is sort of related to one of the big themes of this book, which is that even in the most secularized parts of our society, there actually still is a lot of residual theological, political, whatever influence left over from Christian faith. And I don't think that it's useful for Christians to think of America as a post-Christian nation or as a pagan nation, as you sometimes hear more conservative Catholics say. I think, you know, we really, I mean, I it's the subtitle of my book, and I mean what I say. I think we really are a nation of Christian heretics, even among people who don't necessarily identify as Christians, and that knowledge should inform the kind of debates we sort of set out to have.
Well, that's very helpful. Ross Douthat, we want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.